let you read this real quick, and then I'm going to turn it off and talk a little bit, and then I have a few slides to show you. This is what we mean by the war of the worldviews, and this is a quote from HPB. Old and time-honored errors stand arrayed in battle order, marshaled by blind conservatism, conceit, and prejudice. They are constantly on the watch, ready to strangle every truth which awakening from its age-old sleep happens to knock for admission. Such has been the case ever since man became an animal. Okay. A little bit earlier, Stefan used the word Weltanschauung, a German word that means and has been translated as world view. That word appears for the first time in an incomprehensible paragraph by Immanuel Kant. I urge you to read it and see if you can make any sense out of it. At any rate, it was a concept which was grabbed hold of by other people and used basically with the meaning of simply how we see the world, how we understand the world around us. And this has been adopted all over the world in different languages, different translations, and our translation in English is worldview. Worldview is an important concept in understanding how we deal with reality, because it's one of these things, everybody has one. You know, and it's not, although Webster says it's a comprehensive view of the world and human life, I don't think it just applies to human life. I know that our dogs have a worldview. In their worldview, it's pretty simple. They don't philosophize a lot, but they know that we're there to give them food. They know that we're there to take care of them and take them outside when they need to go. They've got a way of understanding the world around them. They have got a set of assumptions about the way that things are supposed to work. And that's what we mean in general about or by a worldview. A set of presumptions which we hold about the makeup of the world. Another definition has been given as a worldview is a set of beliefs about fundamental aspects of reality that ground and influence all of one's perceiving, thinking, knowing, and doing. So we act out of our own worldviews, and all of us having one will participate in different ways. Now, worldviews, it's an abstract thing, but yet it becomes very real as far as motivating people, because people tend, because of their social and their position in the world, the nations that they're born in, the religions that they have, people tend to share these worldviews. And the worldview begins to become a bigger thing than any one individual, so that people become very, you know, we're all very devoted to our ideas. And so these sort of universal worldviews, ways of seeing things, ways of thinking about the world, we take those on, and we're even, as human beings, willing to fight battles and to go to jail and do all kind of things over these abstract ideas and the idea of the way that we see the world. Now, a worldview can be very, almost at a subconscious level, certain unconscious ways that we deal with things. It can also be a very elaborate system, such as what we have in theosophy or in other philosophies. It can answer many questions about things like what is the primal reality, what is the nature of the world around us, where do we get our ideas of good and evil. All of these things, what happens after death, all of these things are part of what makes up our worldview. And people who belong to different religions and different philosophies, whether or not they put it in writing, they still have some kind of worldview. Now, in the theosophical world, during Dora's time especially, we talked a lot about worldviews. Emily Sellin, who some of you all may remember, was very big on this idea, and she wrote an article that I'll recommend for you if you can find it. It's in the American Theosophist for July 1983, Some Reflections on a Theosophical Worldview. And in a series of meetings up here at Alcott over a number of years, and I don't think, as I was going to say, I don't think anybody here was you know, part of those meetings, we came up with finally this little paragraph that's been circulated and printed in our magazine and everything. And Emily was largely responsible for this, but, you know, other people like Joy and John Algio and myself and Ralph Hannon and Elwood and different ones were up here and involved in those discussions. So we tried to come up with a sort of a simple statement of the theosophical worldview. And I think it's worth for you to take a look at it and reread it and think about it. I'm not going to go into that now because today's what I'm trying to do is talk specifically about HPB, Madame Blavatsky, and how she tried to change and alter the worldview of the people around her. And I think, in fact, that is one of the main things that she did, is to try to alter or to make positive changes in the worldviews that she encountered. Now, in order to do this, she did it in, I think, three important ways. And we're going to go look at each of these and see how they, what they mean. First, she did things that can't be explained on the basis of our conventional ways of seeing the world. These were her famous phenomena. And I don't want to be a mystery or a miracle monger or whatever Stefan called it a while ago, but we're going to talk about some of these things because I think they're extremely interesting, and I don't know very many people who could do some of the things that she's recorded to have done. And the people that were around her had their ordinary reality literally shattered by the things that she was able to do and accomplish. Just things that for her seemed to come second nature, but were so weird that other people had to wake up and think of what was going on here. In the Tibetan tradition, they talk about overcoming ordinary appearances. And certainly HPP overcame ordinary appearances by doing some of these notable phenomena. Okay, besides that, though, she produced a handful of important books and literally hundreds of articles in which she challenged and presented intellectual arguments against the current worldviews that she thought were so detrimental to humanity. And she presented as an alternative to these popular worldviews, fighting in their own ways, an alternative worldview that she referred to as the wisdom religion, the wisdom tradition, theosophy. Other words were also used. But she gave an alternative worldview, which is neither that of, I'm just go ahead and say, the two main objects of her criticism were what she called on one side blind faith, and on the other side what she called blind reason. Okay, one representing superstition, and she saw most religion as a form of superstition, and on the other side, scientism, which isn't science, but is sort of the misapplication of science and going beyond what science is supposed to mean in order to become something equally dogmatic and problematical as religion. So those were her two big foes. She referred to the, and she spoke in very apocalyptic terms about what she was doing. She says it was literally the war of truth against the forces of darkness. And the forces of darkness were these two kind of blindness, the blindness of skepticism and the blindness of faith. And she gave a alternative to that, and that was theosophy. And she did this through all of her literary work, which is just incredible. Now, the third thing that I think she did is she instigated and participated in the formation of a worldwide humanitarian organization tasked with delving deeper into these subjects. And that's us. And we still are part of that movement that she started. And the purpose of this was to continue the work that she began and to continue it into the indefinite future. As Michael said, as long as three people are worthy of the master's attention, the TS literally can't be dissolved as an institution. And so one way or the other, we'll be able to carry on these ideas. So let's look at these things and think a little bit about them. And this is going to be pretty informal, but I'll start with these phenomena. And they're quite interesting. And if you, how many people have read Colonel Olcott's old diary leaves? Okay, maybe half the people. That's a book that is just really worth reading. If you want to, I recommend you do it in chronological order. Just start at the very beginning with Volume 1 in New York and just work your way through, because you'll see Colonel Olcott describing his experience with HPB, and you'll get an idea of his notion for what the Theosophical Society was supposed to be doing. How many people have read Mr. Sennett's book called The Occult World? Okay, a sizable number, but a bunch of you haven't read it. Please read it. This is Mr. Sennett's experience in India after he met HPB. And it really tells some remarkable stories, and it tells how the correspondence that we know as the Mahatma letters got started. And it's really worth reading. In the occult world and in old diary leaves, there are many accounts of HPB's phenomena. So I'll give you a few examples. I'll start with something from old diary leaves. They were sitting around, I guess, at the lamasery where Michael lived. And as they were sitting around there, this was back before people knew that smoking was bad for you. So it was very common for HPB and Colonel Olcott to sit around after a day's of hard work, and Olcott smoked a cigar or pipes. HPB smoked her cigarettes that she rolled. And on this particular occasion, she says, "Olcott, that smoke just smells terrible." And he said, "Well, what's wrong with it?" Well, she says, "You ever tried, Turkish tobacco? And you ever try one of those nice Turkish pipes?" And he says, "No." And she says, "Well, why?" She says, "Well, I don't have one." She says, "Okay, we can take care of that." And she pulls out this pipe. She hands it to him. And this is a fancy Turkish pipe decorated with velvet and, a very fancy kind of a pipe. She says, "How do you like that?" He says, "Well, I wish this velvet part was, it's violet, it's purple, and I wish it was blue." She says, "Okay, here's a blue one." So, well, okay, that's good. She says, "And here's a little bitty one if you want it." And so it was like a miniature version of what she had just given him. And she says, "And while you're at it, here's a coffee pot." "And if you're going to drink any coffee, you probably need some sugar, so here's a sugar bowl." So she just keeps pulling out of empty space all of these things and giving it to her. Here's a cigarette holder. There was about four different things. And at some point, they got rid of most of these things, but supposedly, at the time that Olcott was writing that, they still had the sugar bowl and the tray. And is Tim here? Do you all still have that? Check and see if you still have those things. Yeah, I remember the teacup from New York, but there's supposed to be a sugar bowl and a tray. Anyway, they gave the other stuff away. That's one example. Another example was one time a spiritualist medium guy was there with his little kid, and they were visiting Olcott and Blavatsky. And as little kids will do, this little guy was running all over the place and getting in the way and in trouble. And HPB said, "Well, we need to give him something to make him shut up, So she said, "You need a little toy." So she pulls out, and she's always just grabbing out of space. "Here's a sheep with, on wheels. Here's a little toy that you can play with." So he takes that off. Another time, they went upstairs in this lamasery building. Apparently, Colonel Olcott's sister lived up there, and she had two young children. It was Christmas time. They had a Christmas tree, and they wanted Olcott and HPB to come look at the Christmas tree. So they went up there. They looked around, and Madam started feeling bad because the sister had two little kids, and she said, "Well, I should give you a present or something." Well, she didn't have anything, so she took out some keys, and she started messing around with a couple of the keys. Apparently, she was using the iron of those keys. All of a sudden, where the keys were, all of a sudden there was an iron whistle there. So she takes the whistle off and gives it to the kids. Handkerchiefs that she would just pull out of nowhere and give to somebody. They were talking about the rare Chinese handkerchiefs that were so fine, so she would just pull out a handkerchief and give it to somebody. And then somebody would say, gee, I wish I had one too. She would duplicate it, say, well, here's another handkerchief. And so there's a story in old diaries. She makes I don't know how many different handkerchiefs just right there at the spur of the moment. Sometimes it was actually HPB couldn't go with Alcott to see. They were experimenting, looking everywhere for whatever was of interest at that time. So they went to see a medium that was kind of a famous medium that did seances in the area. And Colonel Alcott went to see this medium. And one of the things that this particular lady did was to materialize flowers. And so she materialized some roses, and she gave a rose to HPB or to Alcott to take to Madame Blavatsky. Madame Blavatsky got the rose, thought that was really nice, and she was kind of playing like that, and all of a sudden it began to get heavier and heavier and heavier, and finally she gives it to Alcott, and this gold ring drops out of the rose. And Alcott said at the time he wrote Old Diary Leaves that he still had that ring. Do you know if that's over there? Because what was interesting is, yeah, what was interesting, it was a plain gold ring to start with, but then when they were talking about it one day, she adds three diamonds to it in a triangular pattern, and that's the form that it's the picture shown in Old Diary Leaves. So maybe that's over there. At one point, she asked Alcott for a seal ring that he had, you know, that has a stone with sort of a cutout impression in that. She took that and shook it around for a little bit, and all of a sudden it began to clink and clank, and there was something else there. So she gave him back his ring, but she had made a ring with a stone that was a green bloodstone, and it had a particular pattern in it, and this is the ring that HPB wore from then on. And I think Annie Besant, do you have that ring? I mean, does it have the original stone in it? Garnet. Well, see, they called it bloodstone. Is that, I don't know if that's different. Maybe they changed the stone at some point. Same ring? Okay, well, anyway, that's another example. There are just innumerable things like that. At one point, and this is an interesting thing about HPB, she wasn't always just the old lady HPB. Sometimes she was overshadowed by some of her masters, and Alcott said he recognized, I don't know, 6 or 7 different personalities that would appear through her and give teachings in different ways, a lot of them having completely different characteristics and manners. And on one occasion, I wasn't supposed to scratch my ear. I've got this thing. At one point... At one point, HPB had a way of sort of appropriating other people's stuff, you know, like pencils and erasers or whatever. And at some point, Alcott had this pencil, and she asked him to use it. Well, apparently it wasn't HPB there at all. It was one of these other somebodies. But Alcott had the thought go through his head, if I give her that pencil, I'll never get it back. Well, whoever that somebody was looked out through HPB's eyes, did her hand like that, and turned it into 12 pencils. Gave him back his, and then there was 11. Things like this were common. They happened every day, but just can you imagine if you were Colonel Alcott, what would you think? What would that do to your normal everyday world if you had somebody with you that was doing this? And for him, being right there, it wasn't a matter of some kind of stage magic or trick or whatever, because they were together all the time. If all of this Turkish stuff had been in a basket or something over there, he would have seen it. It would be very hard to pull all that off. At any rate, these were common things. Then when she went to India, the story of her meeting Mr. Sennett and his experience with her as told in the occult world is just, you know, tremendous and very strange stories. Please read it. One thing that she could do that he talked a lot about was making taps and raps and bells and making different kind of noises and things go on in the room. And as Alcott said, she made these taps and raps on people's heads, in people's heads, in their dental, you know, work, all kind of strange conditions. She would make bells ring in somebody's head. Well, that would change your worldview, wouldn't it? All of the famous teacup phenomena, and Ed's got in his book the story of how that happened. They were at a picnic, and they were an extra guest was there, and they didn't have enough teacups for everybody. And so she said, well, you know, go over there behind that tree and dig up, you know, dig a hole. And they dig, and they find a teacup that's just identical to the other set. And, you know, when they counted all of the ones, it was one extra one that had not been there before. Things like Mrs. Sennett says, oh, I wish I could have a letter from one of the masters. She takes a piece of paper and it sort of disappears. And she says, well, you'll find a letter up in that tree. And poor Mrs. Sennett has to crawl up in the tree to find, that's always a funny picture to think about, but she crawls up into the tree and finds this letter, and the letter's from the masters. I believe I was supposed to leave this here, you know, and this kind of thing took place. One time, Sennett had a feeling that a master had been visiting him during the night. He had had a sort of a subjective sort of experience and knew that something had been taken away from there. Well, he was led to believe that the master had been there, and the fact that he had taken something from his house which would reappear elsewhere in order to show him that he had been there. And so at a later time when they were ready to get this, it turned out to be a brooch from Mrs. Sennett's that they had just taken. They said, well, where are we going to put it? That came up the question, since it was going to be here. And Sennett says, well, let's put it in this cushion. And then his wife says, no, put it in my cushion. Well, anyway, they had to rip open this cushion and reach in there, and there's this letter, and here's this brooch, which somehow was taken out of their house and stuck there. These kind of things happened all the time. But what would that do to Mr. Sennett's worldview? Why do you think that he continued to be a, you know, totally loyal theosophist through thick and thin after that time? It's because his total way of seeing the world as a prim and proper Englishman devoted to, you know, running his newspaper and, you know, taking care of objective facts was completely shattered by this strange Russian woman who could do all these very odd things. She would do things like, it was a lot of times in connection with the master, so you never knew if she was doing it or somebody else was involved or one of their disciples. At one point, Sennett was in his home in Allahabad. She was in Bombay, and had a group of people around there, and as they were sitting there, she could see one of the Mahatmas come into the room in his astral form, go into the next room, take a plaster of Paris portrait off the wall, and break it. So she said, they hear this clatter in the next room. She said, what's he doing? They hear this clatter in the next room. They go in there, and they put it together, and one piece is missing. Meanwhile, basically at the same time, Sennett in Allahabad gets a note from the masters that says, look for this piece of something that we've sent you from Bombay. At that time, the Theosophical headquarters were in Bombay. So he looks in a special place where he put Mahatmic things and all, and found in there this little piece. And later on, comparing him, it was initialed by the master, and this was a part of this thing that had just been broken. It literally happened at the same time. So there again, what does that do to somebody's worldview that has very hard and concrete notions that about space and time and how hard the world is around us and how we have to, you know, deal with all these material conditions when He's stepping into an alternative reality and doing things that can't be explained that way. Anyway, we could go on and on and on with these stories, but they were commonplace in the early days of the society, and they continued to happen. Although she came to regret some of them, they were nevertheless the reason why many people were attracted to Theosophy. It's like Sai Baba or somebody today. You can't, you know, we can say, we can look down from our high and mighty position and say that these phenomena don't matter. But I would like to see somebody do that, and I suspect that some of y'all wouldn't mind if somebody would produce something like that just to let you see that that is really something that can happen. At any rate, this was this phenomenal thing, this showing of an alternative reality was one thing that she specialized at. Okay, the next thing was her literary corpus and all of these books that she produced. And the very first book that she wrote was Isis Unveiled, as we've heard earlier today. And Isis was basically lashing out at these two kinds of worldviews that she thought were so terribly detrimental. That, again, is blind faith and blind reason. In Isis, in the very first part called Before the Veil, and I'm just going to read this to you because HPB could write beautiful prose. I think she was able to describe things in such a wonderful ways. But this is what she says. It is 19 centuries since, as we are told, the night of heathenism and paganism was first dispelled by the divine light of Christianity. And 2.5 centuries since the bright lamp of modern science began to shine on the darkness of the ignorance of the ages. Within these respective epochs, we are required to believe, the true moral and intellectual progress of the race has occurred. The ancient philosophers were well enough for their respective generations, but they were illiterate as compared to modern men of science. The ethics of paganism perhaps met the wants of the uncultivated people of antiquity, but not until the advent of the luminous Star of Bethlehem was the true road to moral perfection and the way to salvation made plain. Of old, brutishness was the rule, virtue and spirituality the exception. Now the dullest may read the will of God in his revealed word. Men have every incentive to be good and are constantly becoming better. I mean, the sarcasm is just dripping, you know, through this whole thing. She says, this is the assumption, but what are the facts? On one hand, the unspiritual, dogmatic, too often debauched clergy, a host of sects and 3 warring great religions, discord instead of union, dogmas without proofs, sensation-loving preachers, and wealth and pleasure-seeking parishioners, hypocrisy and bigotry begotten by the tyrannical exigencies of respectability, the rule of the day, sincerity and real piety exceptional. On the other hand, scientific hypotheses based on sand, no accord upon a single question, rancorous quarrels and jealousy, a general drift into materialism, a death grapple of science with theology for infallibility, a conflict of the ages. So here is this dualistic thing. Here are these two, what she regarded literally as forces of darkness arrayed against truth. She says, between these two conflicting titans, science and theology, is a bewildered public, fast losing all belief in man's personal immortality, in a deity of any kind, and rapidly descending to the level of a mere animal existence. Such is the picture of the hour illumined by the bright noonday sun of this Christian and scientific era. So she's declaring war on these other worldviews. And that's what we're talking about. Now, she wrote some wonderful commentaries on it. And I'm just going to read you a couple of paragraphs to show what she said about religion and what she said about science. And you can gather why she was so particularly critical of these two things. Or I won't say science, let's say scientism, because that's really what we're talking about. But as far as religion goes, this is what she said. She says, we theosophists believe that a religion is a natural incident in the life of man in his present stage of development, that although in rare cases individuals may be born without the religious sentiment, a community must have a religion, that is to say, a uniting bond under penalty of social decay and material annihilation. We believe that no religious doctrine can be more than an attempt to picture to our present limited understandings, in the terms of our terrestrial experiences, great cosmic and spiritual truths, which in our normal state of consciousness we vaguely sense, rather than actually perceive and comprehend. And a revelation, if it is to reveal anything, must necessarily conform to the same earthbound requirements of the human intellect. In our estimation, therefore, no religion can be absolutely true, and none can be absolutely false. A religion is true in proportion as it supplies the spiritual, moral, and intellectual needs of the time and helps the development of mankind in these respects. It is false in proportion as it hinders that development and offends the spiritual, moral, and intellectual portion of man's nature. And the transcendentally spiritual ideas of the ruling power of the universe, entertained by an Oriental sage, would be as false a religion for the African savage as the groveling fetishism of the latter would be for the sage, although both views must necessarily be true in degree, for both represent the highest ideals attainable by the respective individuals of the same cosmico-spiritual facts, which can never be known in their reality by man while he remains but man. So this is a pretty good summary, I think, of her attitude toward religion and the idea that no religion is completely true, no religion is completely false. This is taken from her open letter to the Archbishop of Canterbury, which appeared in Lucifer. In the last years of her life, she wrote some wonderful editorials in Lucifer, and I would urge you to try to get those and read them. One was this open letter to the Archbishop of Canterbury. And in this, it's just a sweeping indictment of modern churchianity, but always recognizing the truth of real Christianity and pointing to what that really means. It's really worth reading. In The Secret Doctrine, she's got a nice paragraph that summarizes her view towards the other extreme. This was blind faith. This is what religion can become. On the other side, we have blind science, which we call scientism, or blind reason, which can be scientism. And this is an interesting statement because, again, this is the whole idea of the way she saw science, where it's good, where it's bad. She says, there can be no possible conflict between the teachings of occult and so-called exact science, where the conclusions of the latter are grounded on a substratum of unassailable fact. It is only when its more ardent exponents, overstepping the limits of observed phenomena in order to penetrate into the arcana of being, attempt to wrench the formation of cosmos and its living forces from spirit and attribute all to blind matter, that the occultists claim the right to dispute and call in question their theories. Science cannot, owing to the very nature of things, unveil the mystery of the universe around us. Science can, it is true, collect, classify, and generalize upon phenomena, but the occultist, arguing from admitted metaphysical data, declares that the daring explorer who would probe the inmost secrets of nature must transcend the narrow limitations of sense and transfer his consciousness into the region of noumena and the sphere of primal causes. To effect this, he must develop faculties which are absolutely dormant, save in a few rare and exceptional cases, in the constitution of the offshoots of our present fifth root race in Europe and America. He can in no other conceivable manner collect the facts on which to base his speculations. Is this not apparent on the principles of inductive logic and metaphysics alike. So as far as science goes, as long as science keeps itself to things that you can weigh and measure and doesn't speculate beyond the range of those things, she's all for it. To the extent that science becomes and if you watch Nova and some of these shows today, you would think that they had everything just totally figured out. You know, they will make statements like, we know it this and that. We know how old the universe is. We know that everything was squashed up in this little point at a certain time in the past. And they'll tell you exactly when that was. They're very arrogant. And she would have been annoyed, I think, because there's way more to it than that. And this would be where she says they're overstepping their bounds and going beyond to what's really not science, but scientism. Scientism is no more science than Islamism is Islam. Okay, it's the same principle. Now, another wonderful article that she wrote was called Civilization, the Death of Art and Beauty. The Death of Art and Beauty. This was another one of these articles in Lucifer. And in this article, she speaks to the other side of science. You know, we always have science and we have technology. We've got science, which looks at primal causes and what's going on and tries to figure out the universe. Then we have technology, which puts this to work in order to implement things in the external world. And it's in that area that science becomes especially dangerous and or can become especially dangerous, as witness a lot of problems that we have today and some of the weapons that we have and some of the ways that we're quick to jump on and abuse the discoveries of science. And I'll just read one little sentence that she's written because I think it's, you know, so good. And again, get this article and read it. She says, owing to the triumphant march and invasion of civilization, nature as well as man and ethics is sacrificed and is fast becoming artificial. Now listen to this. Climates are changing, and the face of the whole world will soon be altered. Under the murderous hands of the pioneers of civilization, the destruction of whole primeval forests is leading to the drying up of rivers, and the opening of the Canal of Suez has changed the climate of Egypt, as that of Panama will divert the course of the Gulf Stream. Almost tropical countries are now becoming cold and rainy, and fertile lands threaten to be soon transformed into sandy deserts. A few more years, and there will not remain within the radius of 50 miles around our large cities one single rural spot inviolate from vulgar speculation. In scenery, the picturesque and the natural is daily replaced by the grotesque and artificial. Scarce a landscape in England, but the fair body of nature is desecrated by the advertisements of Pear soap and Beecham's pills. The pure air of the country is polluted with smoke, the smell of greasy railway engines, and the sickening odors of gin, whiskey, and beer. And once that every natural spot in the surrounding scenery is gone, and the eye of the painter finds but the artificial and hideous products of modern speculation to rest upon, artistic taste will have to follow and disappear along with them. So maybe that sounds a little familiar, I don't know. Okay, so those are her comments on religion and science. The other third thing that she did that I think was so special was to start our Theosophical Society to give an instrument to continue this work that she had begun. And so this is where we come in, and this is where we have the responsibility to carry on and to continue the work that she started. And I think in some ways we've done pretty good. In some ways I think maybe we've failed a little bit. Just to give you an idea of how terribly important she thought the work of the society was, let me read you a little paragraph. She says, she's asking about, this is in an article called Our Cycle and the Next. Again, this is another Lucifer article. This was in May of 1889. She's talked about the cycle of her time, and then she's speculating about what the future will bring. And she says, but what has the new cycle in store for humanity? Will it be merely a continuation of the present, only in darker and more terrible colors? Or shall a new day dawn for mankind, a day of pure sunlight, of truth, of charity, of true happiness for all? The answer depends mainly on the few theosophists who, true to their colors through good repute and ill, still fight the battle of truth against the powers of darkness. This is the war of the worldviews. The answer depends on those few theosophists who, true to their colors through good repute and ill, still fight the battle of truth against the powers of darkness. She goes on to say, and this is still unresolved, if theosophy prevailing in the struggle, its all-embracing philosophy strikes deep root into the mind and hearts of men, if its doctrines of reincarnation and karma, in other words, of hope and responsibility, find a home in the lives of new generations, then indeed will dawn the day of joy and gladness for all who now suffer and are outcast. For real theosophy is altruism, and we cannot repeat it too often. It is brotherly love, mutual help, unswerving devotion to truth. If once men do but realize that in these alone can true happiness be found, and never in wealth, possessions, or any selfish gratification, then the dark clouds will roll away and a new humanity will be born on earth. Then a golden age will be there indeed. And then she ends it this way. But if not, then the storm will burst, and our boasted Western civilization and enlightenment will sink in such a sea of horror that its parallel history has never yet been recorded. So that would make you think. Okay. I've got a few slides to show, and I'll run through these. Since we started a little late, we've got time, I think. People have laughed at everything and scouted every unpopular idea at first, and then ended up accepting it. Materialism and skepticism are evils that must remain in the world as long as man has not quitted his present gross form to don the one he had during the first and second races of this round. This is the picture from old diary leaves of these. I don't think we talked about the sugar tongs. At one point, they had given away a lot of Olcott's household paraphernalia, and they were having coffee, and they wanted some sugar, and the sugar bowl didn't have any sugar tongs to grab the cubes of sugar. And she says, "Well, we need some sugar tongs," and so she materialized those sugar tongs. Now, Olcott says that they're funny looking like that. See, they're kind of like a fork, because she says, if you want to do one of these things, you have to hold a very clear notion of what you want. And apparently she mixed up a pickle fork and the sugar tongs, so we end up with sugar tongs that look like pickle forks on the end. I guess you still have that over there, right?
You know, there's so much stuff there. We have phenomenally produced pictures, we have objects, we have a lot of things.
I mean, I think, you know, people are interested in that, and since we've got them, to sort of go ahead and make pictures and share them with everybody and put them on the internet, I think people would find it interesting. This was a corner of one of the handkerchiefs that she made. This is a case where a famous medium named Staten Moses was in touch with the founders, and he had written them a letter, an HPB. It was like a 5-page letter. She says, "Olcott, we really need to have a copy of that." Well, this was before Xerox machine. So it says, you know, "Give me 5 pieces of paper." So she alternated, you know, letters of this, pages of this letter with blank pages, said, "Put it in that drawer." And about 10 minutes later, they had complete copies. So this is the copy of the first page of that. So this is a sort of an astral Xerox machine or something. And it's almost identical. It's not exactly the same, but very close. This is what she said about in terms of religion and God and all of these ideas. She says, "It is not the one unknown ever-present God in nature or nature in abscondito that is rejected, but the God of human dogma and his humanized word. In his infinite..." I just love Madame Blavatsky's words. "In his infinite conceit and inherent pride and vanity, man shaped it himself with his sacrilegious hand out of the material he had found in his small brain fabric and forced it on mankind as a direct revelation from the unrevealed space. I mean, nobody else could write like that. The secret doctrine teaches no atheism except in the Hindu sense of the word nastika, or the rejection of idols, including every anthropomorphic god. The idea of a personal god was something she just couldn't stand. You know, she thought that was one of the worst ideas people had ever had. She said, in this sense, every occultist is a nastika. It is not the one unknown, ever-present god in nature, or nature in the abstract, that is rejected, but the god of human dogma and his humanized word. Okay, that's the same thing we had earlier. The evolution of the God, this is wonderful, this third one. The evolution of the God idea proceeds apace with man's own intellectual evolution. So true it is that the noblest idea to which, ideal to which the religious spirit of one age can soar will appear but a gross caricature to the philosophic mind of a succeeding epoch. So as we grow, God grows. She talked a lot about pantheism. Pantheism being the idea that everything is God. If you were to talk about the deity or the divinity, everything is formed from that because the divinity has nothing else to work with but its own self. And some people have even, we have another word, panentheism, which is also interesting. That gives also the idea that this deity transcends all of these forms in which it can appear. But pantheism is a word she used often, and she says pantheism may be physically rediscovered. It was known, seen, and felt by the whole of antiquity. Pantheism manifests itself in the vast expanse of the starry heavens, in the breathing of the seas and oceans, in the quiver of life, in the smallest blade of grass. The ancient initiates admitted and taught a great deal of that which modern science teaches now, namely the existence of a primordial world stuff or cosmic substance and the gradual formation of sidereal bodies from it. They taught the revolution of the heavens, the earth's rotation, the heliocentric system, and the atomic vortices, atoms. In reality, souls and intelligences. But those atomists were spiritual, most transcendental and philosophical pantheists. It is not they who would have ever conceived or dreamt that monstrous contrasted progeny, the nightmare of our modern civilized race, namely inanimate material, self-guiding atoms on the one hand, and now to go back to theology, or an extra cosmic god on the other. There your blind science or blind reason and blind faith. This is just an interesting little note. At the time that the HPB was writing, the scientists didn't really understand that there were other island universes out there beyond our Milky Way. They really thought that this was about it. But there were a few forward-looking people who realized that some of the things that were called the nebula, that were fuzzy things that you could see in the sky, were whole galaxies. They didn't use the word galaxy yet, and the idea hadn't sunk in yet. But at this time, she quoted this guy, Professor Newman, who was a famous astronomer. He was an American, and he already began to talk about what he called the resolvable nebulae, which he says were starry clusters. Now we know that that's quite true. She made this interesting statement. This appears in the Secret Doctrine commentary. She says, light is time. If there was no light, you would not have time. Well, now that was way beyond her time. This is a picture of what in science they call a light cone. If that's us in the middle, all of the stuff in the cone coming from above, the 45 degree slope there is the speed of light. That's the way light gets to us. All of the light comes up on the edge of that cone. All the stuff inside the cone down at the bottom is stuff that can affect us now. All the stuff in the cone up above is stuff that we can affect in the future. But the defining thing here is the speed of light, and it's the speed of light which allows you to calibrate between observers moving at different speeds. If you didn't have the speed of light, if you didn't have light, you literally wouldn't have time. You wouldn't be able to define time and the relationship between space and time. She said in one of the commentaries, it's quoted in the Sacred Doctrine, there is not one finger's breadth of void space in the whole boundless universe. Okay, now today, it's very common to hear people talk about what they call the quantum vacuum. Okay, that's so-called empty space, but there's no such thing as empty space. Empty space is full of little, what they call virtual particles, appearing and disappearing. They do it quick enough that by the time you can realize it's there, it's gone again. And it's this appearance of all of these little particles that allow things to stick together and to form into matter. This is where she was talking about the double nature of light, and in fact, of all substance. She says, people used to argue, was light a wave, was it a particle? Was it a wave, was it a particle? She says, undulatory or corpuscular theory, it is all one. It is speculation from the aspects of phenomena, not from the knowledge of the essential nature of the cause and causes. And to know today, we know that, you know, both of these are, just as she said, different ways of describing things. Between events, we have waves. We can calculate where this wave is going. But the wave really just tells us what the probability of observing a particle is, which is the next stage. So it's alternatively a wave, which then it said to collapse into a particle interaction, which then becomes another wave. And these are the two aspects of things. This just shows how the nature of light forms these light and dark areas when it passes through slits. And really, these probability waves determine where a quantum will show up. This is what they call the double slit experiment. If you read anybody trying to describe quantum mechanics, they'll talk about how that you have the wave nature that produces these bands. But in reality, every single band is made of a bunch of little particles hitting, and each one of those is governed by different rules. So you have a wave nature and then a particle nature when it finally reacts. This shows an atom and the fact that every electron in that atom, not just light, but every single electron has a wave nature. It's got a wavelength that you can calculate. And the reason that the electrons are able to stay in an atom is because they form what's called a standing wave that makes up that shell within the atom where the electron lives. And it's all like music. It's all like the Pythagoreans talked about. If you look at the different levels of energy, it's these standing waves within an atom. But HBB saw that way ahead. She says, atoms are called vibrations in occultism. The waves and undulations of science are all produced by atoms propelling their molecules into activity from within. Atoms fill the immensity of space, and by their continuous vibration or that motion which keeps the wheels of life perpetually going. It is that inner work that produces the natural phenomena called the correlation of forces. Hard to state it much better today. It's in right from the Sacred Doctrine. This is interesting too. She says, on the next higher plane, that single element which is defined on our earth by current science as the ultimate undecomposable constituent of some kind of matter would be pronounced in the world of higher spiritual perception as something very complex indeed. So here we have an atom. In her time, they just thought atoms were all one, you know, they're just little like billiard balls. They bounce off of each other. They produce pressure and, you know, so forth. But they had no idea about their internal structure. Now we know that atoms are a nucleus with a positive charge with electrons orbiting around there. If we go within the nucleus, we've got protons and neutrons. If we look inside a proton or neutron, there are these quarks. And there's three quarks in every proton and every neutron. They call them up and down quarks. And, you know, like a proton will have two ups and a down, and a neutron will have two downs and an up. And this is what makes a proton and neutron. And those things, those quarks stick together by exchanging things that they call gluons. Okay, this is the glue that holds it together. And the gluons hold, actually attract each other by emitting other little gluons. So all of this internal structure, you just go on and on and on. She knew about all of that and talked about it. It's pretty hard to say that, you know, she wasn't way ahead of her time. Here's an interesting thing. Our purest water would be found to yield, instead of its two declared simple elements of oxygen and hydrogen, many other constituents undreamed of by our terrestrial modern chemistry. And so within the hydrogen and oxygen atoms in water, we have these internal components of the protons and the neutrons and the quarks and the gluons and all of that stuff. But despite all these rather remarkable examples that show a common ground, there's still some problems. For example, how old is the universe? Well, science says it's 13.8 billion years. The traditional esoteric tradition, it's way up in the trillions. So how do you put those two things together? I'll leave that up to you. Who are the common ancestors of man and ape? Modern evolutionary theory says it was tree shrews. We all go back our physical ancestry to tree shrews. She says it's the lunar petries. How many people know who the lunar petries were? She says we evolved from a type much higher than ourselves. Totally different. Absolutely as far as you can get from the Darwinian theory. She says we believe in, and you know, everybody likes to quote the first three propositions in the first volume because they're pretty easy to understand. You know, you're one underlying principle and it's manifests in cycles and it expresses itself in the evolutionary process. Well, we like to stop there because that makes sense to everybody. But in the second volume, you've got this, the simultaneous evolution of seven human groups on seven different portions of the globe. But these humans are astral. She said the birth of the astral before the physical body, the former being the model for the latter. So we began, rather than tree shrews, we began as giant ethereal forms created from the bodies of these higher beings that she called the lunar petries. And she says, man in this round preceded every mammal, the anthropoids included, in the animal kingdom. And she knows, as you may or you may know, gives a very different description of where the apes and monkeys and things come from. I'm not going to get into that, and I'm going to say what I think about it, or, you know, take a side of it. But we should be aware that this is the esoteric teaching. She's done pretty good in physics. We shouldn't dismiss too soon what she said in biology. Modern science, we talk about a directing intelligence in nature. Modern science says that there's no such thing. The development of the universe is random, and intelligent is what they call an emergent property of complex structures. So because we have a complex brain and nervous system and all the neurons hooked to each other, we have sort of a neural network, and somehow consciousness comes about in all that. You know, a little hand waving there, soon we'll understand that and there'll be no problem. Theosophy, on the other hand, says no, intelligence is there to begin with. It informs and directs nature. There's a very dramatic statement in the Secret Doctrine that says nature unaided fails. So, is there conscious life after death? Science says no. When the brain no longer functions, all consciousness comes to a stop. And I think I want to read to you one little thing here. This is from Stephen Hawking. Everybody, you know, we look up to him. He's really a smart guy and has done so many things, you know, with black holes and all of that stuff. But this is his view on life after death. And you can see, I mean, this is kind of poignant because of his disease. He says, I have lived with the prospect of an early death for the last 49 years. I'm not afraid of death, but I'm in no hurry to die. I have so much that I want to do first. And then here's the kicker. He says, I regard the brain as a computer which will stop working when its components fail. There is no heaven or afterlife for broken down computers. That is a fairy story for people afraid of the dark. So that's what he says. Stephen Weinberg, who won a Nobel Prize for discovering a lot about the weak nuclear force, he says, the more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it also seems pointless. So we've got a ways to go. Finally, I'll end with this. This is what HPB says is required in order to make the next step. She says, the philosophers themselves had to be initiated into perceptive mysteries before they could grasp the correct idea of the ancients. Outside of initiation, the ideals of contemporary religious thought must always have their wings clipped and remain unable to soar higher. So the next step is to develop perceptive faculties. Okay, that's all I have to say.